A new draft constitution for Tunisia. It will further expand the president's powers while reducing parliament. But will it end the political deadlock? And why do some leaders use constitutions to strengthen their powers? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I am Hashim Ahalbarra. Tunisia's President Qais Saied has released a new draft constitution that will give him what critics call royal powers. It will be voted on in a referendum on July the 25th. If passed, the president will be given ultimate authority over the government and judiciary, and parliament's powers will be significantly weakened. President Saied will be able to present draft laws and has sole responsibility for treaties, budgets and appointing and sacking ministers and judges. And the government will have to answer to him. The president will serve two terms of 5 years each, but those terms could be extended if there's an immediate danger to the state. From Tunis, Alicia Walkman has more on the most controversial parts of the proposed constitution.
Article 5, which refers to Tunisia as being part of the nation of Islam, and that the state is the sort of main tool for upholding the values and objectives of Islam. Previously, it was thought that the reference to religion would be taken out of the preamble. So there's a lot of hot debate going on about this. Several articles that are giving Qais Saied a lot more power and also diminishing power for the judges. So one of the things that's been included is a ban on striking for judges as well as military and other state servants. There's quite a big restructure in terms of how the parliament operates. There'll be a national council of sort of regions and districts, and there'll be quite a different state structure. But ultimately, the power resides in the hands of the president. I think one of the things that will be most inflammatory is Article 5, because for the last 10 years, 10 or so years, there's been a hot debate about sort of political Islam. So this is something that has already sparked a lot of debate on social media. And there have been more and more calls for a boycotting of the referendum.
We'll bring in our guests in a moment. First, let's take a look at a few countries that have changed their constitutions to allow leaders to remain in office and strengthen their powers. In 2019, Egypt's parliament approved changes that will let President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to govern until at least 2034. That same year, Togo's parliament allowed President Faure Gnassingbé to rule until 2030. In 2015, voters in Rwanda chose to lift term limits for President Paul Kagame, while Cameroon's parliament extended President Paul Biya's term in 2008. And in 2005, Uganda's parliament backed the removal of presidential term limits altogether. Let's bring in our guests in Tunisia. Zayd Al-Ali, constitutional law specialist and author of Arab Constitutionalism, The Coming Revolution. In London, Alex Vines, director of the Africa Programme at Chatham House. Also in Tunisia, Amin Senoussi, political analyst specialising in Tunisian and North African affairs. Welcome to the programme. Zayd, the 2011 Arab Spring was inspired by the need to put an end to hyper-presidential system where the very few decide the fate of the majority. But don't you see that what is happening right now is exactly the very opposite of what people fought for?
Well, to go back to the 2011 uprising, there were several calls that were taking place at the time, amongst others, the call for social justice. You have to remember that what the underlying factors that led to the Arab Spring in the first place were mainly socioeconomic factors, and people understood either intuitively or explicitly that it was a system of government that was preventing the realization of social justice But if the socioeconomic conditions back at that time, at the end of 2010, were propitious, were positive, then the uprisings would probably not have taken place, or at least would not have taken place in the same form or in the same size. So intuitively or explicitly, people asked for an amendment or a change, a major change to the constitutional systems that existed in prior to 2010. And broadly, what ended up happening is that there was either a very significant or marginal move away from presidentialism and hyper-presidentialism. Mm-hmm. But the problems that ended up taking place afterwards is that the systems as they were established by the post-2011 constitutions didn't function very well for a variety of reasons, amongst others, for example, very weak political party culture. If you establish a system where parliament needs to play a more significant role, then inevitably what you're doing is you're calling for political parties to play a much more significant role. Mm-hmm. And if your political parties are weak by design, incapable of forming policies, so on and so forth, and you see that basically everywhere in the region, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Tunisia, and other places, in all these countries where parliaments are supposed to play significant roles, mm-hmm. then policy formation becomes extremely difficult because you're relying on parties that themselves cannot form policies. So the big mistake at the time was just to create a system based on the assumption that the design itself would be sufficient without thinking about the practical problems that were likely to arise eventually in practice.
Alex, President Qais Saied said that the reason why he's introducing this reform basically to put an end to what he described as dysfunction and endemic corruption in the system. But when you bring about a massive change where you are the ultimate authority in a country at the very expense of the judiciary and the parliament, where are you leading your nation?
Good question. And one that the African Union, the continental body that should oversee all of this, is struggling over. Bear in mind, there is the African Charter on Democracy, Elections and Governance that states a legal means of accessing or maintaining power constitute an unconstitutional change. What we are seeing in Tunisia is something we've seen elsewhere in the African continent in concentrations, as you mentioned in your introduction. I mean, just think back to 2020 with the change of constitution in Guinea. Similar arguments were being asked, were being made there during the referendum campaign by former President Alpha Conde. Unfortunately, the change of the constitution, greatly protested across the country, resulted in a coup last year in September by the military, and there's now a military junta in control of Guinea. So this is by no means necessarily a pathway to enhancing stability and prosperity.
I mean, Tunisians are divided. The nation is polarized. You have those who say he is consolidating democratic gains. You have the others who say this is someone who is driving the nation towards autocracy. Where does it leave the debate, the political debate, as we speak now in Tunisia about their future?
Well, the political debate has shifted since the appearance of the constitution, because before we knew the constitution, people were still hoping and expecting that this will lead to a democratic system and a progression from the 2014 constitution. Since 2 days ago, we have seen a shift in the opinion, because people are now, as you said in the introduction, people are now talking about an eventual boycott of the referendum. And what is interesting is that a part of the upper class are discovering now that Qais Saied's project is grabbing more power. Well, it was obvious for a year, but he used this finalism, this idea that he's fighting corruption by any means necessary to justify his actions. But it was from an exterior point of view, it was obvious that he was trying to grab more power when he attacked the parliament, when he attacked NGOs, when he attacked justice, when he attacked the media. Those were red signs that should have warned us about it. But a part of the upper class and the higher middle class thought that it was, we could accept that in order to get rid of corruptions or of our political adversaries.
Okay. Zaid, in 2014, the Tunisians had their first constitution. And I have to say that the general sentiment prevailing in those countries that were engulfed by the pro-democracy movement back then was that we need parliamentary democracy where the voice of the people decides the ultimate goal of the nation. But we saw that one of the outcomes of that movement was basically the rise of political Islam. Now Qais Saied has a totally different interpretation, which is basically we have to go back to the time where the president has the final say. Is this something which is more because of his biggest concern about the rise of political Islam, or this is just simply a return to autocracy in Tunisia?
Well, okay, so to be clear, the constitution by itself doesn't establish an autocratic system. What it does is it establishes a hyper-presidential system, which would make it easy for anyone who happened to be president to establish an autocratic system by providing all the levers of state and all major powers in the hands of a single person. So if that individual happens to be particularly enlightened and decides not to co-opt the state and capture all state institutions, then they could remain democratic. But the thing is that after 60, 70 years of experience in the post-colonial period in the Arab region, in North Africa, in the Middle East, what we know is that these systems where a single individual or very small groups of individuals who are given huge amounts of authority tend to retain that authority for as long as possible. So whether it's this president or any subsequent president, what the Constitution does is that it doesn't per se establish an autocratic system. What it does is it gives all the keys to the kingdom to that particular individual, and therefore makes it it creates a highly porous state where a single individual can co-opt, if he so chooses, and capture all state institutions if that's what they want to do. And on the issue of political Islam and Article 5 and so on and so forth, I realize that this is always an issue that gets a lot of attention in the media and social media and so on and so forth. But in practical terms, whether it's Article 1 originally, Article 2 in the Iraqi or the Egyptian constitution, Article 5 in the Tunisian constitution, in practical terms, whether or not Tunisia will be inspired by religion and laws will be inspired by religion will depend on who happens to be in charge.
Okay.
It doesn't really matter what the constitution says one way or the other.
Alex, the chairman of the National Consultative Commission, Sadiq Belaid, tasked with drafting of the new constitution, said that the reason why we decide to remove any reference to Islam is that we want to prevent political extremism from taking over. Others say it differently. They say that this was meant in particular to prevent Ennahda, which has been the biggest political organization in Tunisia since 2011, from staging any political comeback in the future.
Yeah, look, this is worrying about political pluralism. And as your previous speaker correctly said, what this is in a real danger of is a pathway to autocracy. We've seen this time and time again, not just, I'm no expert on the Middle East, but in the rest of the African continent, it's exactly the same pathway that we've seen the arguments in the Comoros, Chad, Republic of Congo, Rwanda, Togo, Uganda. So there's plenty of evidence of the concerns of this, including also the closing down of pluralistic space. And so it is deeply alarming, I think, about the potential trajectory of Tunisia, particularly given that Tunisia was at the vanguard of reform in the so-called Arab Spring. So it is an alarming moment, I think, for those of us who care about democracy and political pluralism on the African continent.
Amin, do you see Tunisians coming out in huge numbers on the 25th of July to vote for in the referendum?
I don't think so. I think that's why he didn't set a minimum to the referendum. I think there will be 500,000 people, just like in the online consultation that he did, that Qais Saied organized months ago. But I think that there is this problem with the opposition, that there is a division between going and voting no or boycotting the referendum. That's the main. That's the main issue. While the yes part are very decided and very motivated, because Qaisaid, like it or not, has his supporters, has the people that won't even question the constitution and will go vote yes to Qaisaid, not yes to the constitution. And what was interesting in the previous interventions is really a question that haunts me since I've read the constitution is what Qaisaid did with the 2014 constitution, which was a very parliamentarian constitution, preventing the president from having any power. We've seen the term where he couldn't do anything. Now, what Qaisaid has done with this constitution, with the 2014 constitution, was beyond imagination. And I'm just questioning myself and hoping that my imagination isn't bringing me to an autocracy, mm-hmm. a possible autocracy. But what can Qaisaid do with this constitution? With this constitution that he is hyper-presidential, where there is a lot of loopholes that can lead us to an autocratic system.
Okay, Zaid, in Yemen, Libya, Iraq, Tunisia, Egypt, and many other countries, the political parties that took over came under the hope of trying to stay away from the mindset that prevailed in the 60s, 70s, 80s, all the way towards the 90s, and bring about an inclusive government with new ideas that would put an end to corruption, embezzlement of public funds, and dysfunctional governments. What they failed to do, basically, was reaching out to the people who started the Arab Spring. Do you think this could be the main reason why we're having these new phases in this part of the world where we're seeing an autocracy reinstated back?
First of all, I would dispute the premise of the question. I mean, the premise of the question is that political parties in countries like Iraq came to power with a view to promoting democracy and encouraging pluralism. That's certainly not my impression of Iraq. I mean, it's my country, so I can speak about it with a little bit more freely. But in a country like Iraq, political parties were interested in plundering the state, and certainly not interested in promoting democracy, the rule of law, social justice, and so on and so forth. I mean, if they wanted to do that, it would have been very easy for them. They had huge amounts of resources at their disposal to achieve those things. But there isn't any evidence that in a country like Iraq, and dare I say, places like Lebanon, that political parties have that as their objective. I mean, part of the problem that we have in the Arab region, not in all countries, because I'm speaking very generally, is that political party life, political pluralism, was really decimated over a period of around about half a century by extremely autocratic countries, regimes, where they made it almost impossible, and in some cases completely impossible, to engage in any meaningful political debate, political party activity, and so on and so forth. And then when suddenly there's a big change in a country like Iraq in 2003, and the floodgates are open and political parties can suddenly move in and fill the space that the autocrat has left for whatever reason, mm-hmm. Then you find that their level of capacity, their level of forming, their capacity to form policies and implement them are, first of all, non-existent. And in any event, they have no intention of doing so, because everyone with any type of integrity has either left the country or has been executed. And that's really a problem for people who are designing constitutions.
Okay.
What you need to do in that case is that you certainly want to avoid hyper-presidentialism, but you can't just assume that political parties can do what it takes in order to create a functioning democratic system. You need corrective measures, and that was never done.
Alex, in the past, I mean, the general environment was this. Someone who is really frustrated with a political establishment would stage a coup. What is happening now is what people are coining legal autocrats, like in different parts of the world, Hungary, Russia, in Venezuela, in different parts of the African continent. They use the constitution and democracy to just end up undermining both the constitution and democracy.
Yeah, I mean, we do have the adaptation of constitutions to concentrate power or to extend. So some of it is about setting the term limits back to the clock back to zero and having another two terms. Some of it is indefinite rule. So there are a number of different things happening. But it is a complicated pattern. So you're absolutely right. There are autocratic advances, but there are also setbacks and movements forward of democracy. So it's not one pattern. Mm-hmm. The African continent, for example, is very complicated. There were two democratic advances last year, including through successful elections, which many people didn't expect the incumbents to lose. And that was because the opposition organized themselves very effectively, united, and were able to remove those incumbents. Having said that, there are other countries where that hasn't been possible. My worry about what's happening in Tunisia is that we've seen this before. Opposition parties might boycott the referendum, may get more frustrated, and then support other means that are such pathways as coups, non-constitutional changes of government. That was exactly what happened down on the West African coast last year in Guinea, where frustrated politics, a referendum, resulted in opposition parties encouraging the military to get involved. So this is very worrying.
I mean, are we likely to see a confrontation, imminent confrontation, between Qais Saied and his opponents after July 25th?
Well, it's complicated to answer this question because we need to identify his opponents, because there is different oppositions. There is opponents to Qais Saied who disagree on the person and not on the project. The authoritarian project is in the reform of the constitution, the hyper-presidential system, is supported by some of his actual opponents, like Abdel Moussi and the Dissidentian Party, the former advocate for Ben Ali. And there is another form, there is other forms of opposition who are defending the 2014 constitution and the return to a parliamentary system. I think there is a battle in the opposition to fill in this spot, this alternative to Qais Saied. And that's what is going to be the key to understanding what is going to happen after this referendum.
This is going to be my last question, and I appreciate if you can give me answers in less than 15 seconds. I'll be asking the three of you. I will start with you, Zay. Do you think that it's about time to ask for something like a moratorium on constitutional reforms to put an end to this being manipulated by the dictators and the autocrats to change the states?
No, I don't think so, because you can't have a functioning democratic system without a well-designed constitution. It's not the only factor that you need to function, but you really do need a functioning constitution, a well-designed constitution.
Alex,
so instead of a moratorium, instead of just in one sentence, instead of a moratorium, what I would encourage is deep analysis of why things have gone for so long.
Alex?
I think there needs to be leadership from the continental body, African Union, but reform of constitutions can be progressive. There's a reform conversation in Ghana at the moment, which will strengthen that constitution, make it more democratic.
Amin?
I think the more important is to focus on the political culture. I think what we are lacking in Tunisia is the idea that a collective body like the parliament can govern as efficiently as a presidential system.
Thank you very much indeed, gentlemen. Zayd Al-Ali, Alex Vines, Amin Sanusi, I really appreciate your insight. Looking forward to talking to you in the near future. We see what happens in Tunisia and many other parts of the world. And thank you too for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. For further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Hashim Al-Barra, and the entire team here in Doha. Bye for now.